history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some stories out there that you don't want to miss out on. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And as we take that journey, we end up learning a whole lot. We're educated, we're entertained, and so often inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. Today, I'm in San Luis Obispo, California, with 99-year-old Vic Freudenberger. He's going to turn 100 at the end of January, and they're planning a big celebration for him here at Las Brisas, where he makes his home in San Luis Obispo. But Vic, I want to talk about Philadelphia in the 20s and 30s, because you were growing up.
Right.
I imagine that childhood was a little different from what most people experience now. What are the things you remember about way back when?
Well, growing up, of course, it was a big city, and I enjoyed it, and I enjoyed in the winter. We'd go ice skating and out on the ponds and all in the parks. I lived with my grandparents and my mother. My grandfather had a lot of relatives, and one of them owned a home in Wildwood, New Jersey. We'd always go down there every summer and spend a couple of weeks. They had a big home, which just had rentals for homes for vacation. So that's where I learned to enjoy the water. What happened is I read a book by a famous Marine who started with the Boxer Rebellion and went all through the World War I and all, and received two medals of honor. And so I was kind of impressed by the Marine Corps, by this story. So I figured, well, why not try it? So I, on my own, just decided to enlist. And at the time, there were only 17,000 total in the Marine Corps, 1938. They always said there were more policemen in New York City police force than there were in the Marine Corps. So when they talk about the old Marine Corps, that was it. So I went through boot camp in Parris Island, and then I went to sea school in Norfolk, Virginia for 3 or 4 weeks. So I knew I'd be going aboard a ship, which was great because I wanted to travel. That was part of the incentive. My first tour duty was aboard a new cruiser, the Wichita, heavy cruiser Wichita, which was built in Philadelphia, incidentally, and was commissioned in January of 39. I was assigned as a captain's orderly, which was a pretty choice job because wherever the captain went, you were with him. And so anyway, I was that assignment for over 2 years. Being a new ship, you knew it'd be no transfer for 2 years. But just about that time, the parachutists came into being, that the commandant decided he wanted paratroopers.
You know, to be a paratrooper, you have to volunteer. What possessed you to volunteer for that?
It sounded interesting. Of course, the $55 a month was an incentive, too. So anyway, I just decided it'd be kind of fun to try it. So I volunteered and was accepted, and I went to Lakehurst, New Jersey, and that's where the original training was at the beginning. We had 6 weeks training there, which included 6 jumps to qualify you. We had very strenuous training, lots of running and calisthenics and all. So we were starting out to be in pretty good physical shape.
You know, I'm just curious. You told me, you know, you grew up in Philadelphia, and I know you were selling magazines and papers to earn some money as a boy. So you couldn't play sports in high school. You were too busy with that.
Right.
You never knew your father, your mother, and your grandparents raised you. Had you ever been on an airplane before you were jumping out of airplanes with the Marine Corps?
I don't think I was. I really don't think I was, now that you mention it.
That's kind of unique, isn't it? The first airplane you ever went in, you jumped out of.
Right, that's true.
Were you at all nervous about any of that, the jumping idea?
Well, there's a separate story I would like to include if you want to.
You're the boss.
The day before we were to make our first jump at Lakehurst, there had already been a platoon. The first platoon, the first group that were already established in San Diego, designated as a second parachute battalion. They were making a jump, and the jump went along fine. But at the end, the officer, Lieutenant Ossipoff, was the last to go out, and they normally would throw out cargo also. So when he tossed out the cargo and the static line, which is something that the static line would automatically, you clip onto the static line in the plane,
right.
And then your main chute is pulled open automatically. Well, when he went out, the static line pulled out, and it went out, and he was entangled with the cargo and the static line. And the cargo chute cleared, but he was tailing behind the plane. The plane had no radio contact, so they're flying over the area and not knowing how to. If they landed, of course, he'd be killed.
So he's still entangled, so he's getting dragged behind the plane?
He's being dragged behind the plane.
And there's actually a photograph of him, Walter Ossipoff.
So a Navy pilot and another man flew on an open cockpit plane, and they flew up and were able to rescue him, but they had to get so close to get him clear of the plane that actually the propellers took a portion of the DC-3. That's how close it was. And the interesting part was that we found it at the same time in Lakehurst. We got it on the radio, and we heard this all going on.
Oh, wow.
And so we were making our own first jump the next day. So needless to say, we were, what should we say, scared.
Yeah, that's not very reassuring.
Very apprehensive, let's say. So it was the first time that, and the only time that ever happened.
But they got him safely out of there.
Right, it was quite amazing. Anyway, just to recap, I made a total of about 40 jumps.
So you train there in New Jersey and then more in North Carolina, what we know now as Camp Lejeune. And that's where you were when the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor.
That's right.
So now this is real. You're going to be going to war.
Yeah, right. So as I said, we started doing even more extensive training than we had by spending the whole week, Monday to Friday, in the field, getting a lot of specialized training, creep and crawling, knife fighting, lots of things that the paratroopers were designed to do. We left in May through the canal and to Wellington, New Zealand. As soon as we loaded and we took off and prepared to make this landing, and we didn't know until we got underway to where we were going. This is Solomon Islands, and the large island was called Guadalcanal, and there's another island called Gavutu and Tanambogo, joined by a causeway. Another island called Talagi. The Marines also had what they call raider battalions, who were also specially trained, about the same as we, only they didn't jump. So they landed at the same time the main division portion landed in Guadalcanal. They landed in Talagi. But we didn't get into Gavutu until after 12 o'clock because of shortage of, there weren't enough Higgins boats to land us all simultaneously.
So here you've spent all this time training to be paratroopers.
That's right.
You're not going to jump in.
That's right.
And now by the time you get there, it's about 4 hours after the initial invasion, which didn't meet a lot of resistance.
That's right.
But now the enemy knows you're there and
they're
coming.
There. Gavutu was an island that was quite small, but it had a hill about 300 feet in height, and the whole hill was just full of caves where they could come out and fire and get right back, and it was very hard. Did not offer very many targets. When we landed, we were under fire from there and also from Tanambogo.
And you didn't get right up to the shore. You had to wade in for a ways.
That's right. Our Higgins boat ran aground about 100 yards out. And so we landed about 100 yards. We had to go in under. We were in fairly deep water, as I said, to some of the shorter fellows. I was 6'2" at the time, and it was all up to my chest. So there were ones carrying ammunition and weapons, and some of them was fortunate they didn't drown because they were really in a precarious situation.
And you're getting shot at already 100 yards off?
We were getting shot at, yes. We were receiving fire that far out. So my assistant squad leader was in ahead of me because he was in the front of the Higgins boat where we landed, and I was in the back of it. So he landed before I did, and he was killed instantly. So he got to the, he only got about 50 feet in and was killed. And the arrangement was that we were the A company. We were supposed to go in and move in about 100 yards And then the B company would come in and follow up. So we were the first to land also. So we received the full fire. In the course of the day, out of the 400 men who landed, we had 30 killed and over 100 wounded, which is pretty severe casualties.
And that includes you.
That included me. So after I was wounded, I was treated by a corpsman.
Well, tell me about how you got wounded. So you're there for a few hours.
Yeah.
You're seeing guys killed and wounded around you.
Right.
You're trying to find something to fire at, but it's hard because they're hiding in caves and they have the higher ground.
That's right.
And then all of a sudden, this mortar fire starts coming in from the neighboring island, Tanambogo. They're connected by that causeway, this narrow strip of pavement, as you talked about.
Right.
And so now mortar fire's coming in.
Mm-hmm.
What can you do about that?
Well, you can't do anything about it. Mortar fire is very effective. They had what they called a knee mortar. Their mortar was a small one, but it was effective because the one that landed in which I was wounded from. Also, there was another man next to me. He died from the wounds.
Meacham,
yeah.
So the mortar hits between the two of you?
It hit between the two of us, and he got the major portion of it. We knew he was seriously wounded. He was unconscious and was taken down right to the waiting for the first boat, but still took another hour or two before we were evacuated.
It's time for our first commercial break, but we'll hear about the extent of Vic's injuries when we come back. Vic Freudenberger, 99 years old and turning 100 in a matter of weeks. There is much more to come with this 22-year veteran of the Marine Corps when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.